Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Why Bitcoin podcast, the podcast where we question everything, but mainly why Bitcoin. I'm your host. My name is Jeff, joined here today by no co-host today. My first time flying solo, but luckily I'm joined by a wonderful guest by the name of Jimbo Coin. Jimbo Coin, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks.
Right on, man. Looking forward to chatting with you. If this is your first time listening, just know we talk about Bitcoin stuff and things here, but nothing that we say here is financial advice. Although I do believe that you should buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. And Jimbo, that's where I always like to start, man. Where do you stand on, where do you stand on clown world? What do you think? Do you think the world is ending? Where do you stand on just the fiat situation in general, especially things heating up in Russia and China? What's your personal take on all this fucking shit going on?
Oh, well, that's a really great question. I was not prepared for in all of my studying for today's chat. I don't know. It's so funny. You know, I go outside and, you know, it's like a sunny day and the weather's nice and, you know, take the dogs out and stuff and everything seems to be okay. And then you go on the news and it's all fire and brimstone. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. And, I don't know. I feel like, and this is the thing that boggles my mind. It's getting harder to tell what's true. It seems, especially with these new like generative models that can make all kinds of true looking pictures. So it's harder to tell what's true, but at the same time, we have the tools to know for certain with cryptography. And, you know, Bitcoin's a great example of that. So we have at the same time, we have the tools to know for certain something. And I mean, Bitcoin doesn't give you any better access to underlying reality, but at least, you know, it's like, no, this was signed by these keys. I know that, right? You can know something for certain. And then the world is becoming less certain. Maybe the world was always less certain, and now it's just now we're just realizing it. But anyway, that's I don't pay a whole lot of attention to foreign matters like you were just discussing. So I don't have a strong opinion. Yeah,
interesting. Okay, first off, I completely agree, man. That was one of my aha moments with Bitcoin. It was just like everything is bullshit in the world, but at least Bitcoin is telling the truth. It's like a breath of fresh air when you're just like, here's the transactions, here's how they occurred, and this is where the coins are. Like, just knowing that that exists in the world, just that absolute truth, feels very it's one of the things that brings peace to my life. It's funny that you bring that up, man. Like, does looking at Bitcoin bring you peace? Because it seems like that's where you were going.
Yeah, it seems like there's a premium for knowing something for certain, and the fact that that premium exists just makes it surprising to me that it's taking so long for Bitcoin to take off. Because, I mean, not that it hasn't taken off to some degree, but every day that Bitcoin is not millions of dollars per whole coin is a mystery to me. Because it's like we have a perfect order machine that creates truth claims that are inviolable, and yet everyone's worried about clown world. And it's like, okay, well, we have the technology, like it's here now, but yet I struggle to be able to persuade people about it.
Yeah, dude, I feel the same way. Like when I got into Bitcoin, I figured everybody was going to figure it out right away. I thought I was one of the last ones, and then everybody was going to jump on board because it's so glaringly obvious. Bitcoin just seems so obvious to switch from shitty fiat to perfect Bitcoin. And yet it's just people aren't asking the questions and people don't give a shit about the truth. I think that's what it is, man. Some people just don't care about the truth. Have you always been a truth seeker? Wait, hold on. I'm already getting caught off. How about you start by explaining, I like asking this question. Who are you? And in terms of what do you believe your role is in the Bitcoin space? What would you classify yourself as?
Wow, just pigeonhole my whole experience into a terse one-liner. It's hard to say. What I had tried to do, I don't think is necessarily what I'm necessarily going to be best at. one of my skills, so my day job, I'm a software engineer, and in particular, I'm a specialist in data visualization. So making, you know, bespoke visualizations to make sense of novel or you know, unique and different data sets. So my job in a lot of ways is about taking information in bulk and then condensing it into something that speaks to somebody, which is also what memes are. And I like memes. I'm not as good as our very excellent Bitcoin marketing team at making the memes. But it's part of the same skill set, which is you take something complicated, you take a complex scenario, and then you break it down and you come up with the core nugget, the little part that you, the parcel that you can present. And so that's what I try to do. I don't know that I'm necessarily successful. Aside from that, I'm also in some quarters of the internet known as the super cycle guy. I'm always talking about how, you know, in any room, somebody's got to be the most bullish. So I try to just go full moontard some of the time. But that's about it that I can say quickly.
You don't have to be quick about it, man. That's funny. The super cycle thing is hilarious. I was looking at your tweets and I saw it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but was Supercycle not started by the one and only Dan Held, or is that just something he stole from somebody else?
That's a fantastic question, and I don't know. I actually don't know whether he ever had an original thought, and whether this would have been one of them. I just love the word, and it really fit nicely with the worldview that I thought we were heading into in early 2021. Like many other people, I thought that $100,000 Bitcoin was a lock-in, like a sure thing in 2021. And for whatever reason, that didn't occur. We can speculate on why. Some people speculate it's because of the paper Bitcoin with FTX. Some people speculate that it was the China mining ban, you know, that put a damper on everything. It could also have been that people just got distracted by monkey JPEGs. I mean, there's a lot of potential reasons. But from my mind, I was saying, okay, well, $100,000 is guaranteed. How far do we go from there? And my whole super cycle thesis was built on how far do we overshoot 100K and whether or not we can make it the rest of the way. And clearly that didn't pan out. So at this point, it's a dead theory, but a live meme. And I'm happy to, you know, just continue to be that guy.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah, let the people know the super cycle is coming at some point. At some point, we'll see the super cycle. You know what's interesting? I like to, the whole price talk, right? It's so weird because some Bitcoiners say the price doesn't matter. And I'm definitely guilty of saying that. I've said it for fucking 100 episodes now. But the more I think about it, the more like the price is the signal, right? The price is what shows you that fiat is dying. The price is what shows you that Bitcoin is winning. Because if the price didn't matter, truly, then there would be nothing to say which is the best out of all the fucking coins. You know, if the price didn't matter, then any of the coins could be a good coin, technically. But I think it does matter. It kind of shows you, hey, this is where the money is. It's just so happens that right now it's represented in US dollars or whatever your local currency of choice is, right? So to bring it back, yeah, like why didn't we go to 100K? We were all, I mean, I was definitely thinking we were going to 100K and forever up to, 100 million last year. But yeah, that didn't happen. I think it's a lot to do with the paper Bitcoin. And I also wonder, you know, I'm a big believer in the cycle theory that we see these 4-year cycles. And I think we're going to go into another one. I think it's shocking that some people think that that's not true. But my question is, like, this is what I've been thinking about lately, and this is kind of a bull-tarded comment too. Could 2020 cycle have been the outlier in that it was underwhelming, and then maybe going into 2024 we'll go back to ridiculous skyrocketing prices? What do you think? Or do you think we kind of just keep trending is a more and more less and less volatile, I guess? What do you think? I mean, anything can happen. What's your opinion?
Yeah, these are great questions that I think about all the time. The thing is that, so okay, So just, I warned you before we started the show that I have a bad habit of talking in paragraphs. And so this is going to be one of those things. People think about price and they'll say, you know, oh, well, money's flowing into Bitcoin or money's, you know, flowing out of. And that never made sense to me because, like, if you're buying Bitcoin, somebody else is selling it. So money doesn't flow anywhere, right? Bitcoin comes into existence through the mining subsidy. It leaves existence by lost keys. You know, there are maybe a few, some provably gone, you know, coins, but most coins that are lost are of unknown destination. Like they could move, you know, who knows? So Bitcoin doesn't really get created or destroyed. So the idea of money flowing into Bitcoin is kind of, it's like an optical illusion, right? You know, if you buy Bitcoin, to you, your money has flowed into Bitcoin, but somebody else's money, quote unquote, flowed out. So to say that money flows in or out doesn't really make sense. So then you have this price signal. And what price is it's the realization of desire. And it's the realization of the net desire or the marginal desire that people have between two things, right? You're dividing one thing by another. You're dividing it, you know, Bitcoin by its fiat price. So it's psychology, right? It's how much do you want something reified on the margin, right? And so some people, some hardcore hodlers, you know, I would include myself in that, are like, this thing is worth millions of dollars per coin at current dollar valuations, like dollars as they exist right now, this second. Why would I possibly part with them? Other people are like, yo, I'm going to day trade. That's cool. You know, and that's fine. YOLO. So price is psychology. So what that means is you have to understand people. And so one thing you have to understand about people is people are not good with numbers, especially not big numbers, and they're not good with very small numbers. So $30,000 for a Bitcoin sounds like a crazy amount of money. And people say, like, I can't afford to spend $30,000 on some crazy internet money, but I can sure put 79 cents into a Doge or, like, you know, something stupid. And that's how they think because they have unit bias. Now we try to say, oh, sats the standard and stack sats. And I think a lot of effort, I think a lot of progress has been made on making that real. What I predict is going to happen is eventually the price of Bitcoin will be so high that it will be ludicrous to continue to bundle them in 100 million sat tranches, right? Right now, the BTC price is 100 million sats tranche, and we trade it exactly like that, just like a mortgage-backed security. So a mortgage-backed security has, you know, some thousands of house mortgages all bundled up into one tradable security. That's what we do with BTC. We take 100 million of these sats and we bundle them together and then we give a price to that bundle. And that made sense when Bitcoin was, you know, a dollar for a whole bundle of them, when it was, you know, so cheap per sat that it only made sense to bundle it like that. So we're in this world where $30,000 is too much. So you go down to the sat price. Well, what's the price of one sat? It's something ridiculous, like a tiny fraction of a cent. And people are not good with decimals. I mean, really tiny numbers with lots of decimals are hard to reason about. Numbers that are large, like thousands, are hard for people to justify. Like, I can't spend that on a crazy internet money. So we're in this, like, wide chasm where you have a Bitcoin is too expensive and a sat is too cheap. And people want something that they can bet on, like, oh, okay, I can buy one of these. I can afford a whole ether or whatever. And it's stupid. So my whole premise, and this was super cycle theory, is that eventually we pass $100,000. Eventually. I don't know when that'll be. I had thought it was guaranteed in 2021, but clearly I don't know. So eventually we pass $100,000. Now the crucial question to me is, do we make it to 300K? Because at 300K, on a log scale, you're halfway to a million. I know literally halfway to a million would be 500K, but on a log scale, 300,000 is about halfway if you're looking at it in that way. At $300,000, people start to speculate, like, could this thing go to $1 million? I don't know, maybe. What do you think? Do you think $1 million Bitcoin is possible? Blah, blah, blah. It becomes a psychological attractor. Well, once you get to $1 million Bitcoin, well, $1 million for Bitcoin, a sat is 1 cent. And if it's a cent, now it's a penny stock, right? And then it just doesn't make sense to talk about these, you know, 100 million Satoshi tranches anymore. And that's when we just switch to, we just keep the BTC ticker, but we just move the decimal 8 places. And like, nah, Bitcoins are a penny, right? They're a penny stock now. And then that's what the ticker becomes. Well, and now everybody says, oh, well, shit, I can buy some of those. They're only a cent. I thought Bitcoin was like hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, no, man, you can get these for a penny. Like, dude, get on it, right? And then you suddenly you go from 1 cent sat to 2 cent sats overnight. That's Jimbo's super cycle theory, roughly, is that it's a psychological multi-stage rocket. The next stage of the rocket is 100K. And the question is, in my mind, do we overshoot 100K far enough to get to 300? And then if you get to 300, does it have enough psychological sticking point to get you to a million? Because if you can get to a million, then now it's just vertical, right? You go 1 million, 2 million, 10. Now you're at 10 cents. And then people start wondering if you can get to a dollar per sat, right? So it's all psychology and it's all psychological. And there's going to be a snowball effect. My whole principle of super cycle theory was that we would undergo that snowball effect in 2021. But because we never got to the first stage of that rocket, we never got to see the rest of it play out. So nothing has changed about my thesis in terms of the psychological analysis of those stages and it being psychology and it pulling people in based on their innumeracy and their inability to think about fractions. All of that still plays out. I just don't know when do we hit 100,000? But I don't think it's going to be before 2025. Because again, okay, so I'll pause there. I'll pause there. I'm sorry. I've already spoken way longer than I intended to.
Yeah, you can keep rolling, man. I have a few questions, but you can keep rolling. Tell me what you think of 2025. Or do you want me to break down a couple things?
If you have questions, yeah, whatever you want to do. It's your show.
Think of this, right? Because right now it's easy to mentally think of Bitcoin and dollar value, but also, for so long, Bitcoin has been going up in value against the dollar. And what a lot of people aren't realizing is that the dollar is going down in value against Bitcoin. So like this last little run up here, you know, we're going to see the price of everything go up simultaneously with Bitcoin at the same time, right? So Bitcoin could go to, I don't know, even if it goes to 100K, we could see a gallon of gas go to, I don't know, 5, 20, whatever, something absurd that we would think of right now, and a jug of milk would cost $40, $50. So yay, we have, but everybody's looking at Bitcoin like, okay, well, it's just kind of staying on par with the price of everything else. So it's going to be interesting to see that shift, right? So maybe we'll go through a phase where Bitcoin is just showing the devaluation of the dollar, and then people are going to be like, well, dollars are shit. So it will also trigger people to say, well, if I don't want dollars because everything's getting expensive around me, what can I do? Well, at least this Bitcoin thing is going up while everything else is going up. And I think that'll be a major catalyst as well for people to shift over. I don't know when that's going to happen. I don't know if I had a question there.
No, that's a good point. I mean, you know, the valuing of other things. I think to your point, if we were to see that sort of like hyperinflationary price going up of everything, I think, yes, that would hopefully cause people to question whether or not something else that goes up would be worthwhile. People, when they're fearful, aren't necessarily the most like reflective rational and thoughtful. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I think, so here's the other piece about Bitcoin psychology is everybody thinks that they're late no matter when they get in. Right. I thought I was late. And everybody thinks they're late and they have to catch up. And that's, I think, partly the appeal of shitcoin degeneracy, whatever form it takes, is people say, oh, okay, well, I'm behind, but maybe I can catch the next one. Or maybe I can trade my way to try to catch up to what I should have had if I would have gotten on earlier. So I think if we had a price situation where, you know, a hyperinflationary situation where all prices are going up, that would put incredible pressure on people to try to catch up even more. And I think you'd end up with just a bigger cycle of shitcoin degeneracy, unfortunately.
Yeah, dude. Okay. So I have a friend, I've referenced this friend in quite a few episodes now, but he's got a neighbor that he was just talking to. And, you know, my buddy's going around saying, hey, you should look at Bitcoin. And this neighbor's like, oh no, I just bought this new thing. It's better than Bitcoin. It's going to replace the Swift network. And I'm like, oh fuck, he bought XRPs. So, and that's like the second or third or maybe fourth time I've heard somebody bring up XRP in the last little while. And yeah, just to verify what you're saying about unit bias, it's insane, man. Cause people will say, oh, well, I can buy, you know, 100 of these XRPs. And if they go up to this percent, then I'll be rich. It's so opposite of what Bitcoiners are trying to do. It's so, it's so frustrating because, yeah, it's changing your mentality on what the price means or what a price means in general, I think is an important part of understanding Bitcoin. Like, yeah, the price is going to go up, but really what you're seeing is a change of the unit of account that you're using for your money value. Instead of organizing things in dollars, you organize them in sats, and it's just a way better life. But for so long, we're going to see people continue to think that the dollar is the best unit to measure prices in, and they're just going to keep buying shit coins. And it's I think it's just inevitable. I think it's just annoying, and I think there's just a lot of I'd like to call these people stupid, but maybe they're not stupid. Maybe they're just intellectually lazy. They don't want to put the work in, you know, because you don't have to put that much work in to understanding Bitcoin to realize that all the other shit is garbage. All you have to do is take a fucking couple hours, watch a couple videos, and you'll realize, oh yeah, I don't want any of these shit coins. I just want Bitcoin. And like all the regular reasons people have for buying these shit coins is just, it's the same fucking thing over and over again. Anyways, I digress. Somehow I always end up ranting about shit coins, man. It happens every time. I'm trying to stop doing that. Let me ask you this, because we kind of skipped over it. I'm kind of curious then. Can you give us your the classic, the Bitcoin podcast classic question? Can you tell me what your Bitcoin story is, how you got into it, where it first touched you, and how you became? Because you're very clearly quite the maximalist, which I appreciate. So I'm curious how you got to this point in understanding Bitcoin. So go in as much or as little detail as you want, man.
Oh, yeah. So that's a good question. So I'm embarrassed to say that it took me a long time. So my first contact with Bitcoin was probably in around 2011. A colleague of mine, said, hey, you know, check out this thing. It's on Slashdot, and they solved the double spend problem, and there's a white paper PDF, and you know, it seems legit. And I said, no, that sounds like a scam. And because everybody thinks it sounds like a scam when you first hear about it. And in addition to that, and this is just my own hubris that I had to get over, I had a pretty lousy experience of academia. And so anytime I heard white paper, or I thought like research academia, and I didn't like it. And so I was like, I'm not going to read that. You know, so that was 2011. I heard about it again, you know, probably around 2012, with the Cyprus banking crisis, when people were using Bitcoin on the ground there to try to have some money when all the banks in Cyprus were having issues, and Silk Road and WikiLeaks and all that, right? So that was that time frame, and that was when I heard about it again. I'm like, wow, that scam is still around. That's so weird. I wonder what the price is doing. And I started looking at the price in 2012. And it was down at that time. It was like $9. And I had looked at the chart and I was like, well, it used to be $25. I don't want to buy this thing if it's just going to die. That would be stupid. So I didn't do anything. And then in 2013, the price got back up to $25. And I was like, oh man, it's hitting new all-time highs. I bet this thing's going to go to $100. So I got an account on Mt. Gox, as one does at the time. And wired some money to this shady Japanese exchange. And I bought one Bitcoin for like $127. And then in 4 days, it went up to $135 and I sold it. I was like, yes, I just made $8. I'm like, I'm the best trader in the world. And then I took my money back off the exchange and left like 10 bucks on there just to play with. And now I'm a Mt. Gox, creditor. Waiting to have to go to Japan and get my money back in actual yen, because $10 was not worth it for me to go through the whole like process. But that was my first experience. And then after the Mt. Gox collapse, I had a lot of life things happen, and the price crashed from $1,000 down to whatever it was, like $150, around 2015. And I just kept watching, and I was like, "Is this thing going to recover?" I didn't know if what I was watching was like the slow, long death of Bitcoin. And the thing is, at this time, again, I had never done any research. How do I say it? I didn't like go on the forums, you know, and back when I first heard about it, I was in the middle of writing a book about databases. Like I had everything I needed, except I just wasn't humble enough to just say, yeah, maybe this is legit. And so I was just watching it. And so then, the Trump election of 2015 caught everybody's attention and was like a, you know, its own shitstorm. I say 2015, that's when he like started announcing that he was running. Then 2016, everything went haywire. And then after the election of 2016 and 2017, when the price finally hit new all-time highs off of the Mt. Gox high, right, we finally passed like $1,400 or whatever, I said, holy shit, this thing's never going to die. And I just had conviction. And so that's when I fell down the rabbit hole, so to speak, was 6 years after I had heard about Bitcoin. It took me 6 years of like checking in on the price every now and then and thinking about it to actually do research. And then once I did research, I started chatting with some of my work colleagues, and I realized that the questions that they had were things that I had already researched, because it would touch on a bunch of different things. When you start learning about Bitcoin, you end up learning about the fiat money system. You end up learning about economics and Austrian economics, and you learn about technology and cryptography and philosophy and all these various things that all weave together. And found that my colleagues just had none of that background. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna have to write a newsletter where I just like decode all this stuff. This was also, again, during 2017's like ICO mania in the summer of that time. So I started to write a newsletter, and that ended up getting longer and longer because I just realized more information that my friends just didn't have. And I said, I should write a book. So I started to flesh out what a book would look like. And I realized that it was going to take about 600 pages to explain what I felt like I wanted to say. And then I realized nobody's going to read a 600 page book. So I chopped it down and said, okay, what can I release in sections? And then got it down to about 155 pages of what I thought was like introductory material. And that's what became my book, Orange Coin Good. And that I didn't release that until 2020, when we finally hit new all time. Or no, what was it? I think I released it on like the white paper day in 2020, because it just took me more time to really distill what I thought I understood. But anyway, so that's my story. Is I heard about it in 2011, got wrecked on Mt. Gox in 2013, fell out of the loop for several years, and then fell into the rabbit hole. I guess class of 2017 is what I would call myself. If pressed to pick.
Dude, that's a wild story. And just listening to that, man, you shouldn't beat yourself up, because I say this a lot. I came in the very end of 2020, when things were just starting to pick up for that bull run. And it was so easy for me to do the research, to learn about what was going on, to learn about what Bitcoin was, because the amount of educational tools available was just absurd. And that's only become more and more extreme. There's literally thousands of podcast episodes you can listen to understand Bitcoin, hundreds of books. I kind of feel bad. I should have researched you better. I didn't know you had a book, so we can talk about that a little bit more in a bit here. But there's so many books, good books at that. There's so many videos, articles, just everything. It's so easy to become a Bitcoiner. And so whenever I talk to somebody that's back from the 2011 days or 2013 days, you know, you have to give them, I give you guys props, because like, fuck, man, what were you going off of? There was nothing around. I'm sure there was a couple guys spouting out what Bitcoin was, but it's definitely not like today. So that's another reason why I think Bitcoin's only getting easier and easier for people to understand, because the amount of education out there is only growing. Like, it's exponential how easy it is to learn what Bitcoin is. Whereas back in 2011, you know, nobody knew. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew what it was going to do. And like you said, it had died for the first time, the first major crash. And it must have been pretty easy to think, well, it's crashed, so it's over. And then it comes back to life. You're like, okay, that's interesting. And then it crashes again. And then it comes back to life. So then you start to realize, like, oh, this is just what this thing does. And anybody new coming into the space, Jimbo, I bounce around on our show, right? Like, sometimes I think I'm talking to brand new Bitcoiners. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking to hardcore maximalists. I never know exactly what my target audience is. I should probably try and sort that out, but it is what it is. But it's just so fucking easy to become a hardcore Bitcoiner. The information's out there, and it's because of guys like you that had those touch points way early on and didn't have the ability to figure out what was going on. And now it's just so easy. So anyways, I just want to say, don't beat yourself up for having coins on Gox. Nobody could have seen it coming. That said, anybody that had coins on fucking Celsius or BlockFi or fucking FTX, it's like, yeah, you could have fucking seen this coming. You know what I mean? Like, it's so obvious now. It's infuriating. That's a good question. Does it infuriate you to see the same fucking scams come up over and over again?
I guess I would say it surprises me. So, you know, the first round of shitcoinery that I was really aware of was 2017, when there were a bunch of, like, I think that was the beginning of the ICOs, right? So, I mean, I was aware of Ethereum in 2016 when it came out. I think that's when it came out. I was aware roughly of that, and I was like, ah, that sounds stupid. And then I was aware of the shitcoins in 2017, and then 2018 you had, like, the Echo ICOs and the IEOs and all that stuff. And I was like, okay, all right, I think we've all had enough of that. So then, you know, a cycle later, after 2020, I was like, we're never going to go through that again. Like, everybody would have seen this by now, right? So it takes a couple of times. Like, you have to, you know, the first time you hear about Bitcoin, you're like, oh, that sounds like a scam. Then the second time you're like, holy shit, that scam's not dead. Maybe I'll look into it, right? Or maybe I won't. But it takes time. It takes several, like, contacts. So my mistake is I'm sitting here thinking of it from my own perspective, and I have to stop doing that. Where to me, this is like touch point number four or something, and I'm like, okay, yeah, no more of those scams. Like, to me, the scams of 2017 were pretty transparent. Like they were, to me, they seemed pretty obviously scams. I did not at all see DeFi and the monkey JPEGs coming. Like, that totally surprised me, because the thing is, like, we'd already been through CryptoKitties on Ethereum back in, like, 2017. So I was like, okay, we've already seen what happens when people try to put collectibles on these blockchains. It's a fad, and then it disappears. So, like, nobody should fall for that again, right? And then they did. So is it frustrating? I guess a little bit. More, it's just surprising. Like, I just get surprised that it would happen. So now, based on that experience, I fully expect 100% there's going to be a brand new batch of scams based on the old scams, but with a brand new name. They're going to be called something else. I don't know what they're going to be called yet. It's going to have a brand new name, new slick marketing, new round of influencers, new alt season, shitcoin season, probably 2024. That's now my baseline assumption. I don't assume that everyone's going to be smart enough to avoid it anymore.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I was thinking too. It's like the quote unquote alt season is going to happen again. All these people are going to see people get dummy rich off all these coins. But the things I'm telling, like, my people is, listen, you're going to see people get rich, fiat rich. That is, they won't even be Bitcoin rich because they won't know to transfer their max gain, their fucking sick gains, into Bitcoin. But aside from that, by the time you hear somebody saying, oh, you should buy this thing, it's already too late. Like, that's what people don't get. It was the thing with Doge or shit, like Shiba, whatever, all that shit. It's like, once you've heard that it's time to buy it, it's already too late to buy it. So that's what I'm trying to tell people, is what it is. I kind of want to yeah, we're going so off, but this is fine. So you said you were writing a book on you said you were writing a book on databases. Is that correct? Did I hear that right?
Yeah. In my outside of Bitcoin life, I've written a couple of technical books.
So then let me ask you this, dude, because all I try and explain to people, like, in my mind, maybe you can tell me if you agree or disagree. To me, a blockchain is just a shitty database, right? Like, the only reason a blockchain, I hate saying that word. Like, the only reason Bitcoin has value is because it's decentralized and everybody's running it. Any other blockchain has no value because, like, you'd be better off, any of these given quote-unquote blockchain projects would be better off with just a centralized database because it's easier to control. And that's what their goals are anyways. So I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on the whole blockchain tech. Did you ever, and do you now, see any value in blockchain tech in the context of it being a database?
Yeah. So great question. The word blockchain is a little overloaded, to use a programming term. The word blockchain to a lot of people. I had a long argument with a colleague of mine several years ago. It's probably like 2018, 2019, where I was trying to tell him, I was like, blockchains don't make sense for anything except money. And he's like, no, no, you can use them for all this other stuff. And it was, God, it was probably like 45 minutes or an hour before I finally said, okay, let's just agree on what a blockchain is. Like, describe to me what you think it is. And what I realized was his definition of a blockchain was basically using cryptographic hashes in a database, right? And I'm like, okay, if your definition of a blockchain is I'm going to hash some data and store hashes in a database, then yes, that technology is perfectly reasonable to use for all kinds of things, right? So for example, let's say you have a row in a database. A row, for people who don't know, you can think of a lot of databases, and in this case, I'm talking about relational databases. You can think of it kind of like a spreadsheet. You know, it's got columns and rows, and typically a row is like a record, just like in a spreadsheet where your columns might have different pieces of information, like headings, and then a row is like a one entry, like a person, a purchase order, or whatever, right? So you could, in a database context, take your row of data and hash it, run it through SHA-256 or some other hashing algorithm, and store the hash along with your row. What that would tell you is later on, so then, you know, now, you know, 4 months later, you know, like all this time passes, then you go back and you're looking through your database and you're like, okay, I'm just going to take the data in my rows and hash them and make sure that the hashes still line up to the hash column. And if they don't, then I know that something went wrong with that data. There was some kind of problem. So you can use hashes just as a checksum to make sure nothing went wrong. This is a really like rudimentary example, but it would be a reasonable use for hashing data in a database. That's not what a blockchain is. Like the point of a blockchain in the parlance of, you know, the original white paper, which I think actually doesn't mention the term blockchain, but, and that's why everyone gets all up in arms about blockchain versus time chain. But conceptually speaking, when you're using a blockchain model, you're taking a block of transactions, a bunch of transactions, and you hash them. And then that hash value also includes, when you're taking all these transactions, it also includes the header or the output hash of the previous block. That way, the only way to compute a block is if you had the previous block. It creates a chain of blocks where each block points to the block before it. The real key to Bitcoin, the thing that makes it a decentralized system that is not controlled by any central party, is the proof of work algorithm. So in addition to just hashing the transactions and pointing to the block before, that's not enough. You also have to have the hash that you produce have enough zeros at the front, basically, to satisfy the difficulty. So based on how much, based on how quickly blocks have come out in the last period of time, in Bitcoin, it's 2016 blocks, based on how quickly on according to the wall time, according to the clock on the wall, how quickly those 2016 blocks came out, the difficulty will either be adjusted upwards or downwards. The point being that stochastically, that just means like randomly, on average, you'll get a block every 10 minutes. That difficulty readjustment based on proof of work is what allows blocks to come out at that 10-minute increment and also makes it incredibly expensive to rewrite the database. Why is making it expensive to rewrite important? Because if it's not expensive to rewrite the database, then somebody would do it, right? Which they would just undo the work or assign value to themselves or, you know, what's the word? Defraud somebody. They would send the coins and then be like, no, no, it's takesy backsies. I never sent you that transaction.
Double right? Spend is what you're trying to
yeah. Yes. Yeah, they would double spend. So the purpose of a blockchain, a proof of work blockchain is to create a consensus algorithm based on Nakamoto consensus described in the Bitcoin white paper, which makes it incredibly expensive to rewrite the chain, and therefore it becomes difficult to tamper, incredibly expensive to tamper. That's the reason for it. And so you don't need that feature for almost anything except money. Like, if we can just have that feature of being incredibly difficult to reverse transactions on money, you don't really need it for other things. Like, I've been yet to be convinced that you need that level of irreversibility outside of the context of a monetary unit.
I agree, man. Yeah, there's nothing else I would bother running a code for other than the accounting of my sats. I try and bring it back to needs, right? It's like, what do you need this blockchain for? What do you need this project for? Oh, you can do blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. Like, I can't even think of a fucking stupid idea that these guys are doing. But for me, it's just Bitcoin is a good accounting of sats. And so that's why it's important. And you know what, dude? This kind of rolls in good to what our topic was supposed to be about today. Running a node, man. Like, let's get into that a little bit. So why don't you explain what a node is and what it does and whether or not you think it's important for an individual to run one?
Sure. So in the Bitcoin network, there's a type of software called a node software. Your Bitcoin node connects you to the shared ledger. You have a copy of the ledger. Whether you want to keep the whole copy or not is up to you, but your node is how you access the ledger. It's kind of like how your web browser gives you access to the internet. Your node gives you access to the Bitcoin network. If you run a full archival node, then your node will have a full copy of every transaction that has ever been included in a block. And yes, I do think it's super important to run your own node, but the reason is because it answers the question, how do you know, right? So stepping back again, talking philosophically, in Bitcoin, you'll hear people say, don't trust, verify. And to me, that's kind of a reflection of this philosophy of like, how do you know, right? How do you know that nobody else has your seed? How do you know that you've actually received that payment? How do you know that there's not more than 21 million Bitcoins? Like, you know, how do you know, right? You hear these things, but how do you know? Well, the way you know is by verifying it yourself. And how you do that depends on which part of the system we're talking about. But running your own node is how you know that you've received coins. So let's say you're receiving coin, right? You've bought some from an exchange, or maybe somebody's agreed to pay you for, you know, mowing their lawn or something. So they send you a transaction. They say, here, I'm sending you the coin we discussed. So now that transaction, you can see it, you know, your wallet shows you that transaction exists, but how do you know that it's been included in a block? Now, wallets will show you that this is an unconfirmed transaction or it has some number of confirmations. A transaction goes from unconfirmed to having one confirmation when it is included in a block that is at the tip of the blockchain, right? So a transaction in a block that's at the block height, the highest block, that has one confirmation. When another block appears and points back to that block, now your transaction is too deep. It's at the second block in the chain. So now you have two confirmations. And then six confirmations is, for most intents and purposes, considered irreversible. You know, again, we can talk about whether or not that's appropriate, and it depends a lot on the type of transaction you're doing. But, you know, common knowledge, people will say six confirmations is enough. So after about an hour, again, getting blocks about every 10 minutes, your transaction will be about six blocks deep in the blockchain. And the way that you know that is because your own node will have received those blocks and validated that those blocks include only transactions which follow the network consensus rules, and that the block points back to the previous block, and that the block has sufficient work according to the then difficulty of the network, which, as I mentioned, gets updated every couple weeks. So yes, running a node is important. It's how you know that you have received coin. That is the purpose for running a node.
So, okay, I'm kind of a bad Bitcoiner, dude. I shouldn't even admit this on my show, but I still do not have a node set up. I'm going to get one set up soon, okay? I already hear the gasps coming in. I'm going to get one set up soon. I had plans to get one set up, then we crashed. I'm very poor. I can't set one up. So question number one, what do you think is the most economical or cheapest way to run a node? How can I do this on, like, for cheap? Because the thing is, like, you'll see Bitcoiners come in and say, oh, buy a Raspi and then do this and do this. It's like the costs get up there, and to new Bitcoiners coming in, especially somebody that's comes in at the top of a bull run and then drops all their money in. Okay, now all of a sudden I have no fiat to go spend a couple hundred bucks on little gizmos and gadgets to run a node. So are there cheaper, more economical ways to run a node that I could do rather than buying the go-to thing? Or like another example is the Umbral box, which is, again, you know, you're talking about devices that are like 400, 500 bucks. So I'm trying to figure out how to do it cheap.
Yeah. So the cheapest option for running a node is to download Bitcoin Core, which is free. It's open source, and run that on a machine that has roughly, you know, 6-7 gigs of hard drive space available. And then you just run a what's called a pruned node, which means you don't keep a copy of every transaction forever into the past. You only keep transactions back to like the last 6 months. You know, but at least that would give you enough, like that would allow you to know when you receive coin that it was in fact confirmed. Right. So that would be the cheapest way. It'd be to download Bitcoin Core for free and run it on any computer that has 7 gigs, roughly 6-7 gigs of hard drive space available.
Fuck. Yeah, I should really do that. Okay. This is the other thing that's been holding me back. So just as a example here, because I don't know how else to ask this question. I do a Bitcoin transaction. Okay. I've gotten sats sent to me from X exchange or X person to my wallet. And now I have them. And that was, say, 2 weeks ago. So we've seen 2016 blocks go by. And in my wallet app, it has, you know, that many confirmations. After six, like you said, it just says 6+. Can I, without running a node and verifying it on my own node, can I still be sure that the sats in my, for example, my blue wallet, are there? Or do you think they would still be unconfirmed unless I run them through my own node?
Yeah. So you say, can you be sure?
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. Let's go philosophical then real quick. So a little bit of divergence into philosophy, and then I'll come back and answer your question. So I've thought about this a lot. The question is, how do you know, right? That was, I mentioned before, the key question. I've come up with, I think, 4 ways that you can know something. One way is direct experience, right? You were there, man, you know, like that's a way to know. Now our memories are fallible, but at least like being there and it, you know, if you can't trust your own senses, I mean, you've gone full Matrix. So we have to start somewhere. So direct experience. Let's say you don't direct experience something, because like clearly we are not electrical beings that can, you know, reach our little electrical feelers out into the network and talk to the network. So we can't do that. So what's another way to do it? Well, another way to know something is replication. So an example of this is in the scientific method, in the, you know, the Renaissance, somebody would come up with some sort of claim about the way the universe worked, and then you try to replicate that. And if a lot of people can replicate the experiment, well, then you know something is true. So maybe you weren't there for the initial thing, but you can replicate it. That's the second, in my opinion, the second best way to know something. So the best way is to be there. Second best, or do it yourself. Second best way is to replicate something, and you can do that with a process that's a black box. If a process replicates, you can know it. Third way to know something, if you can't be there and you can't replicate it, can you at least audit it, right? So this would be an example where, you know, maybe you want to buy a company or something and, you know, you weren't there for the company's business transactions, and obviously you can't replicate the company. It exists, but you can maybe audit their books. So they give you access to their books and you go through the books and you audit them and you say, okay, yeah, this looks legit, or no, it doesn't. So audit is you look into the way something works, even though you can't necessarily do it yourself. And then the fourth way to know something is to delegate, right? So delegate is AKA trust. You make it somebody else's problem. So in the buying a company sense, you might not actually perform the audit. Instead, you delegate the auditing to a third party who trades on their reputation for doing good audits. Okay. So then you say, okay, I'm not going to run my own node. So then how sure can I be that I actually have those coins? Well, you are delegating the the checking of that. You're delegating the verification to a third party. Well, what third party is it? Well, if you're using Blue Wallet, Blue Wallet by default connects to an Electrum server. I can talk about what Electrum is and what an Electrum server is, but it connects to an Electrum server that is run by the Blue Wallet organization. So somewhere Blue Wallet is running an Electrum server, and that Electrum server is telling you that yes, those addresses do have the transactions that you think they should have. So whether or not they're telling you the truth, whether or not you are connected to Blue Wallet's Electrum server and that connection hasn't been tampered with, it's highly unlikely that somebody else would be getting in the way and feeding you bad data. But you're delegating to some company. Whether or not that company is reputable, you're trusting somebody else, basically, is what's happening.
That's fair. So if I go back then, and so I've made a bunch of transactions on the Bitcoin network, and I never ran a node, but if I now, next week set up a node and then I run the Bitcoin Core, I can verify them all. How would I go back to check my own transactions? Would I just go look in the chain and say, oh yeah, there's the one that I did, there's the one that I did, and then give her the thumbs up? Is there a way to do that easily, or what? And then conversely, dude, like, as an attacker, attack vector, I just thought of this, right? So I make a bunch of Bitcoin transactions, I don't run a node, and then a week from now, I run a node, I go back and I say, nope, that transaction was wrong, that transaction was wrong, that transaction was wrong. What's stopping me from doing that? I think I just answered this question in my own head. But why don't you tell me why I can't do that?
Well, you said you made a bunch of transactions. Did you broadcast them to the network, or did you just save them off as files on your computer?
Yeah, broadcasted to the network.
Well, yeah, if you've broadcasted them, then those transactions appear in the mempools of other nodes. The mempool is basically just the mempool is a term people use that means the set of transactions that have not yet been confirmed. They're just in the available pool of transactions that could be confirmed, and miners use the mempool to build blocks. So if you've broadcast transactions, then at minimum, those have appeared in your neighbor's nodes' mempools. Now, whether or not your neighbors forwarded those transactions is a function of whether or not the fee that you put on your transactions was high enough and whether or not they feel like it. Nodes can choose not to forward transactions if they don't feel. There are nodes, for example, that will only forward blocks, like whole completed blocks, and just don't forward transactions. That's a configuration setting you can set. So in general, probably the network has now seen your transactions. Whether or not they got confirmed is a function of network congestion and how much fees you paid. Did you pay enough fee to get your blocks in those? Did you pay enough fee to get your transactions in the blocks? Is a question that may or may not be the case. But what stops you from undoing them? So let's suppose you sent the transactions with a very low fee, like less than one sat per V-byte. It may be that they're still in the mempool, and in that case, you could send new transactions that spend the same funds, a double spend, as it were, with a higher fee. This is called a replace by fee, and then your new transactions would take precedence. And again, whether or not they take precedence, so this is a bit of technical minutia, but in general, that's how it works. So yes, you could undo a transaction if it has not been confirmed and you want to replace it with a transaction that gives a higher fee.
Right. And then alternatively, the other obvious answer, I guess, would be if you want to run your node and say that those transactions didn't exist, then you would just create a fork and you'd be running your own version of Bitcoin that nobody else would. So it wouldn't follow consensus, right? So you'd just be, your node would be kicked off the network.
Yeah, you could leave consensus if you just say, I don't accept those blocks that include those transactions that I don't like. Yeah, you could fork off.
We've seen some people do that. It doesn't usually work out well for them. No. Okay, dude, what do you think is more important, running a node or having a hardware wallet?
Okay, so...
It's a tough question.
Yeah, Yeah, I guess. I think they're both important for different reasons. And also, I want to point out, I want to say up front before we get into the hardware wallet thing, that I'm a multi-sig maximalist, so I would not advise people to use a single hardware wallet for reasons that we can get into. But yeah, I would say they're just for different things. The purpose of your node is so that you know that you have received coin. You don't even need it. You don't even need to run your own node if all you're doing is spending. So, for example, you could conceivably run a node in the beginning of setting up your wallet, then you receive a bunch of coin, and then you're like, well, I don't need this anymore, and just like chuck it. Because like you've received coin, you know that that's in the blockchain, in the ledger. You don't necessarily technically need your node anymore. Because when you go to spend, when you go to sign transactions, you don't need your own node to broadcast the transactions. Any node can do that. So you could just, email the transaction to a buddy and be like, hey, can you broadcast this for me? And now it's out there. So the purpose of a node is to know that you have received coin for certain. So as long as you want to be receiving Bitcoin, then yeah, you probably want to be running a node. The purpose of a hardware wallet is to protect your keys from leaks during use. So the and the reason why I'm really specific about that is because people often employ hardware wallets for things that I think they're not for. But those are the reasons. So as a so I was listening to a previous show that you had done where you had Matt O'Dell, and he was explaining the difference between, for example, your seed phrase and the keys, the private keys that you use. The using of your seed to generate the private keys would be an example of in use. That's a calculation that involves the private keys and must involve the private keys. So that type of calculation would be something that you would want to use on trusted, quote unquote, trusted. You'd want to use it on dedicated hardware that is hopefully offline and has a relatively compact attack surface area. So the purpose of the hardware wallet is to protect your keys from leaking, so they don't get out in the internet because, if anybody else had your keys, they could move your coins. And the hardware wallet protects your keys from leaking during use. The reason I emphasize during use is because sometimes people will use a hardware wallet for storage of keys as well, right? They're like, oh, I just leave my seed on the hardware wallet. And that's fine. You can leave your seed on the hardware wallet. But to me, that's not the purpose of the hardware wallet. The purpose of the hardware wallet is to protect the keys during use. For the storage period between uses, you certainly can leave it on your hardware wallet, if you want, but relying on your hardware wallet to protect your keys from, say, a physical attacker, to me, that's outside the purview of what the hardware wallet is for. Like, you may as well just keep it on, steel or paper or, whatever else, physical media, or in your brain. But the point is that storage is a separate security concern. The hardware wallet is for during use. That's my two cents.
Here's kind of a, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
That is kind of off the wall here, but on your own Bitcoin journey, as we all go on, like for me, I learned what Bitcoin was. I started to dig into it, and I went down the what is fiat, how does fiat work, and then what will Bitcoin do for the world, and how will it change society? And I really went heavy into that, and I stayed away from really diving deep into the technical aspects of how Bitcoin works. I mean, I can hold a conversation, but I definitely am not like a tech expert. So I'm kind of curious, like, just for you personally, how much hours of time have you put into understanding the code of Bitcoin, how it works, and was that kind of your more like what was that the exciting aspect of Bitcoin for you? Was the tech side of it and how it runs and what it does and keys and nodes and all this stuff, was that kind of where you went on your Bitcoin journey?
Yeah, so frankly, I have not done a lot of review of the code proper. I did read Andreas Antonopoulos's book, Mastering Bitcoin.
Okay.
I found that to be pretty illuminating in terms of like the way that transactions work. I learned a lot from that book and would recommend it, despite his later shitcoinery with Ethereum. Yeah, but no, I had full conviction that Bitcoin was indestructible. Again, in 2017, when it hit new all-time highs and Mt. Gox didn't kill it, like I was like, okay, this thing's the cockroach that will survive the apocalypse. I didn't even know how, I didn't understand how mining worked. I didn't understand how the Nakamoto consensus or the difficulty readjustment, all that stuff I would learn later. I had conviction before I learned any of that stuff.
Yeah, man, I hear you. That's kind of where I was at too. And I almost feel like I did myself a disservice. I'm like, damn, I've been learning about Bitcoin for a few years now. Barely scratched the surface. Like, it's just, there's so many different lanes you can go down when you're learning about Bitcoin. There's so much to learn. Yeah, I haven't touched Andreas's book yet, but as of late, I've been listening to his speeches back from 2014, 2015 on YouTube. There's some good shit in there. I like that guy, and I think he's coming back around. But yeah, man, there's a lot to know. Okay, back to nodes. This is another question for you. Do you think the need for, sorry for kind of bouncing back around, I still don't have a smooth way to run my show, but do you think the need for an individual to run a node is going up over time or down over time? And I ask this question because I don't want to sound like an asshole, but you know, there's going to be more and more people running nodes for their own self-interest, and there's going to be a lot of people that come into Bitcoin that don't even know what a node is or why it is or what it does. So do you think that that's okay, or do you think that we as Bitcoiners should be pushing people to run their own nodes more and more and more and have a node in, you know, in every Bitcoiner's possession?
Yeah, great question. So if you don't mind me doing another philosophical detour.
Give her.
Yeah, so, okay. In the physical world, okay, let's talk about ownership. Like, what does it mean to own something? I promise I will get back to the question of the importance of running a node. I hell swear, yeah, to God.
I love the what is ownership. I fucking think about this all day. So go ahead. You tell me what you think.
Okay. So as far as I can tell, there are three different ways that we can think of owning something. If you are alone out in the wilderness, say, and you build a log cabin, right? That's your log cabin. But in order to maintain the log cabin, to own it, you have to maintain its boundaries, right? Weeds are going to want to grow up in there and it's going to get moldy, or wild animals might try to get in, right? You have to maintain the boundaries of that property. Whatever property you own, you have to maintain the boundaries. So in nature, in a state of nature, ownership is what you can defend, right? I live outside, you know, there's some woods near my house. I hear the blue jays, right? The blue jay owns the tree because it's willing to defend the tree against other blue jays coming over there, right? So in nature, ownership is what you can defend. In society, and we can talk about the reasons for this, but in society, the current organization of much of society is in terms of states, which is a monopoly on violence. So in terms of owning something in a state society context, it's not about what you can defend, because you're not actually allowed to defend it, right? You are not permitted to use at your own discretion violence. That monopoly is withheld from you and maintained by the state. So in society, ownership is what the law permits, right? Does the law allow you to own five chickens on your in your backyard, to use an example, or to buy raw milk? What the law permits is what you own, right? So that's in society. Okay, so now let's talk about Bitcoin. So in Bitcoin, ownership is knowledge. You either know the keys or you don't. The keys are just information. We often hear about people stamping seed material into steel or writing it on paper, but in reality, that's just information. It's just information, and you either know the keys or you don't. That's the promise of the Bitcoin network, and that is the guarantee that it affords. If you know the keys, okay, this depends on the technical, you know, I don't know the technical level of your listenership.
Just do whatever. We'll figure it out.
That's
okay. Yeah.
So one way to think about Bitcoin is it's kind of like a big spreadsheet of numbered accounts. And when you have some Bitcoin, what you really have is the ability to move funds from some of those cells into other cells. So, and your ability to do so is based on your knowledge of the keys. We've never had that before, right? And I say we never had that before. What I mean is since the dawn of agriculture. So if you haven't read the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, I recommend it. It goes through this. But our pre-agricultural ancestors didn't have to worry about too much about centralized violence, because if somebody was violent against you and your tribe, you could just pick up and leave. People didn't have a lot of belongings, and the belongings that they did have, they could carry with them. There wasn't a lot of staying in place. Once humans started developing agriculture, though, that went out the window, because you can't get up and take the farm with you. Like, if you leave the farm, it's not your farm anymore. And so as a result of that dynamic, people created defensive coalitions to protect themselves, and or you had violent thugs just come in and control area. The modern nation state is the pinnacle of that developmental pattern, wherein the violence is controlled by, you know, an increasingly small minority that decides what everybody else does. So that again, all of that is in the physical world of people. But in Bitcoin, ownership is knowledge. So now suddenly, for the first time since agriculture, you can get up and take your stuff with you, right? You can fit your Bitcoin in your head. You can fit your Bitcoin on a 3x5 card, any amount of it, and just travel, right? And move around. So how important is it? Ownership is knowledge in Bitcoin. The more you know, the more you can own. You have to know and understand your keys in order to own Bitcoin. If you don't have your own keys, it's not yours. Somebody else has it. It's just an IOU. If you know how to run a node, you can know that you've received coins. If you don't run your own node, you can't know that. And, you know, we never got around to talking about hardware wallets and multi-sig and all that other stuff. But the point is like, the more you level up and the more you know and understand Bitcoin, the more capable you are of owning this precious thing that we've never had before in the history of humanity. The great pharaohs of ancient Egypt didn't have this power, right? They would die and they'd bury all this gold and, you know, their servants along with them and their cats and all this stuff. And then those tombs would get raided, right? The pharaohs wanted to take all this stuff with them to the afterlife, and they couldn't. The stuff stayed behind. But Bitcoin you can take with you, because ownership is knowledge. And if you die with the keys in your head, those keys are gone and nobody will ever get them before. And what this does is it changes the balance of power, again, in a way that we haven't seen since our hunter-gatherer ancestors, thousands of years ago. Now you can take you can have in your head all of your wealth and travel with it. So the violence centralization, the state enterprise, is no longer a competitive model in a Bitcoinized future for extracting labor. And because ultimately that's what the state has to do. The state doesn't need money. That's another discussion. I'm getting too far off track. But anyway, to answer your original question, how important is it to run your own node? I think it's going to be increasingly important. The people who run nodes, the people who have their own keys, the people who are able to know this stuff, they're the ones who are going to be able to own. If you don't know the keys, if you don't run a node, if you don't know how to do this stuff, you will not own. You will owe. Somebody else will own, and you'll just get an IOU.
That's fair. Fuck, I gotta get my node set up. I've been really putting it off, man. I feel like an asshole. That's good shit, man. Yeah, dude, I come from the camp of, I really think Bitcoin is a necessity. And then I think of, what's his name? I think it's Maslow's hierarchy, right? So it's food, water, air, and shelter. And like, those are the things you need to live. And then after that, you just need Bitcoin, because that's how you acquire those things. And so when you say, what is ownership? I'm like, oh yeah. Like, can you own your water? Not really. If somebody takes a cup of water out of your hand while you're drinking it, it's not yours anymore. Like, it's not yours until it's in your body. Same with air. You know, we saw, I don't know where you stand on all the COVID shit, but I like to speculate and say they tried to make the air owned by the state, right? They said, hey, you can't breathe the fucking fresh air around you. We're going to make you pay for a air filterizer and all this bullshit. And obviously food, if you don't produce your own food, then you're owned by the state and you don't own it if you have to go buy it. And shelter, again, once again, you pay taxes to the state to quote unquote own your house. So really, you can't own anything, even your basic needs for life. And then Bitcoin comes in, it's like, this is something nobody can take from you. So I like to think of it as like the term, the word own, wasn't even properly defined until Bitcoin came into play. And I feel like you share that understanding. So I always appreciate when somebody's on that level, man. Appreciate you. I don't think I had a question there, but I just kind of wanted to share that thought. Do you feel like Bitcoin changed the definition of what ownership means?
Yeah, absolutely. And people just haven't necessarily picked up on it yet. It certainly has for me. I mean, like I said, I've given this years and years of thought, as lots of people do when they come into contact with this thing. And yes, it has changed the nature of ownership. I mean, cryptography in general has given us the ability to know for certain that something occurred, right? Not something in the real world, but something of a cryptographic nature. Like, I know that this key signed this thing because nobody can reverse this calculation, you know, and Bitcoin just extends that a little bit. So, you know, we now have the situation where ownership is knowledge. If you know it, you can have it in your head. And so what that means from a philosophy of violence standpoint is that in the past, right, if you kill the farmer, you get the farm. And that's why we have states, because they can centralize the violence. And that's a more effective, it's a more efficient way to fend off other such thugs, right? Other gangs of thugs, right? And the state is basically the biggest gang of thugs. Where if you kill the farmer, you get the farm. If you kill the Bitcoiner, you get nothing, right? You're now significantly less likely to ever get their coin than if they were still alive. Because at least if they were alive, there's a chance. But if you kill them and they had all the coin in their head, it's gone now, right? So Bitcoin changes the dynamics of the payoffs for violence. It doesn't change the dynamics of violence that is not for payoff. So if somebody's just crazy, or they, you know, they're an embittered lover who is passionate about murdering somebody, Bitcoin doesn't affect that because it's not for money. But violence for money, extortion, taxation, those types of things, Bitcoin does fix those, because you can just say, no, you can kill me, but you can't have my Bitcoin, right? And that's where we're going to.
I go back and forth on that, because here, let me ask you this question, see what you think of it. The idea that you can kill a Bitcoiner, but you can't get his Bitcoin. So if you extrapolate that out as far as you can, you could say there's two, here's the example. There's two kingdoms, right? One kingdom has 10 Bitcoins. The other kingdom has 10 Bitcoins. And Kingdom A goes to Kingdom B to try and steal their Bitcoins, and they kill the king. And the king has all the keys in his head, and they can't get them, but the king is dead. So they weren't able to acquire those additional Bitcoins, but they did just make the total supply of Bitcoins down by 10, making the coins that they own more valuable. What do you think of that theory?
No, that's a good question. So let's talk about why money is valuable. So money is the ultimate speculative vehicle. People like to call things speculative vehicles as though it's some sort of an insult. It's like, no, it's just a term, right? So with money, you speculate that no matter what else happens to anything else in the world, people are going to want your money. It's the thing you always expect. It's the thing you speculate people will want, even if they don't want anything else you have on offer, right? It's the ultimate speculative vehicle. So what that means is, at the limit, the more people that there are in general who want your money, the better that money is for you. Because if more people want what you have, then they're willing to compete with each other to give you something so they can get it. So in your hypothetical, dystopian bipolar world of two kingdoms, if one kingdom murders the other kingdom and reduces the Bitcoin, well, if that destruction reduces the number of people who are able to buy and sell things, then it impoverishes the whole collection of people. The hypothetical example is a little odd to me because, and so, you know, because this is your podcast, I'll engage with your hypothetical. In general, when people pose these hypotheticals, I always start asking questions like, well, how did we get to a world where there's only two, right? What about everybody else? How do they feel about it, right? And, you know, I start asking those types of questions because for any given scenario, you can come up with an arbitrarily constrained hypothetical situation that makes the opposite answer the one that you want. But overall, I would not worry about people killing in order to reduce the total amount of Bitcoin in circulation, because I don't think it'll be, how do I say it? Like, for Bitcoin to be that valuable, enough people have to want it, right? Because it's a network good, and the more people who want it, the more valuable it is. So if Bitcoin is really valuable enough that the total quote-unquote market cap of all Bitcoin is so valuable that somebody would be willing to kill to reduce the market cap of all Bitcoin, I don't think at that time any particular entity has enough that killing them would make a difference, right? It's at that point, it's so widespread, it's so out there that killing someone in order to reduce the total amount out there doesn't make sense, unless it's Satoshi. Right, unless it's literally Satoshi.
Dude, that's a fucking badass answer, man. I've been that's what my brain does, man. I just think of all the ways Bitcoin can fail. Or I was a utopian believer. I'm like, oh my god, Bitcoin is going to bring life to beautiful, everything is going to be glorious. And so I went a little bit too hippy dippy, so I tried to pull myself back, and that's where I'd come up with these situations like, okay, what about this and this? But yeah, you're right, the more logical thing for those two kingdoms to do would be, in that hypothetical, would be to interact with each other, because they both want to produce things of value to acquire the other kingdom's Bitcoin. So it makes more sense to produce value rather than to just try to cut off your enemy's head. So then where do you stand? Do you think, like, have you seen Tomer's video, Bitcoin is Generational Wealth? I'm a big believer in that. I fucking bawled my eyes out when I watched it. Like I said, I was a big utopian believer, and I try and pull myself back. So where do you stand? Do you think Bitcoin brings in a utopia, or yeah, where's your head at in that?
Yeah, so I haven't seen that particular video. I do think there are a lot of positives that will come from this Bitcoinification. Some of them seem relatively simple. So, for example, you're probably familiar with shitflation, where because the prices of inputs to things go up, or things are harder to get, but yet the price is sticky at the retail level, the creators of things will try to put shittier things in them. So you'll get, boxes of cereal that are more air than cereal, and they'll just increase the volume of air in the box, same size box, but they'll just put less cereal in it, but then keep the price the same. So it takes twice as many boxes of cereal nobody should eat cereal. This is not nutrition advice. I advise you not to eat cereal, but it would take more cereal to, like, you know, create the same number of calories, more boxes, because they put less in. That's a natural consequence of a couple of different psychological factors. One is the fact that prices are sticky. So the retailer, the person who's trying to sell the box of cereal, they don't want to increase the price because people don't like to see prices go up. And that psychology goes all the way down the line. Nobody wants to increase their prices if they can afford it. So they find ways of hiding it. They find ways of, like, making it less good so that they can keep the price the same. Right. So that's in a fiat expanding money supply, exponentially expanding money supply that impoverishes everybody world. So the opposite ought to happen under a Bitcoin standard. So under a Bitcoin standard, you have a price of something. You're used to going and buying, you know, some kind of a thing, a sandwich or whatever. And then the value of Bitcoin is going up in terms of things, right? Because that's what Bitcoin value does. And so the sandwich producer doesn't want to start receiving less Bitcoin for their sandwiches. So they have to find some way to, like, make the sandwich better so it's still worth it to you to buy, right? So you'll have this opposite effect where instead of things getting shittier and staying the same price, they'll stay the same price but get higher quality, which I think will be pretty amazing. But that would be an example of something I predict will happen.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah, I never thought of it that way. I just figured, you know, like with the price going up, people are going to get less and less sats for work, but you just have to come to terms with the fact that your purchasing power is going up, so the less sats doesn't matter. But you're right, people are going to have a hard time coming to terms with the fact of, hey, I'm getting less of this unit, I'm getting less sats, that's not good. It's like, yeah, but the things you can buy with it has gone up. So even though you're getting less, you can still buy more. But people are stupid and prices matter. So you're right. People will make better shit. Man, that's a good theory. I like that theory.
I don't worry in general about, people worry that like, oh, well, you know, technology is going to take our jobs and what are people going to do and all this. And I just don't worry about it because that is the nature of all technology for all time has been to eliminate drudgery. Right. I have a dishwasher in my home and I love it. I love that my dishwasher washes dishes. Like, I mean, it broke recently and I had to get it fixed, but you know, that notwithstanding, like it's fantastic. I don't have to sit there and wash the dishes. It's more efficient. It's great. Love it. That's the nature of all things, right? Is that, technology improves and then things that we used to have to do, we no longer have to do. And so you mentioned air earlier, right? You don't have to pay for air because it's just out there in the world. And that's true in most cases, but there are cases where you do have to pay for air. So for example, if you're going scuba diving, you've got to bring a tank of air. You either have to produce that tank of air yourself or get it filled somewhere, but you got to pay, right? One way or another, you got to pay for the air. you know, and things like clean water that we take advantage of, we take for granted here in the first world, you know, fresh water, fresh, clean water is available. It's very cheap. I mean, you go to a restaurant, they'll give you a glass of water for free, right? I mean, there's water fountains that are just out that you can just go use. You know, a retailer that's trying to sell you stuff will have a water fountain and you can just go, or you can just go use their bathroom. Like these facilities that you'd have to otherwise pay for are just free because they're so cheap to provide that they're given away at the point of making the customer happy. So I tend to think that that's the direction that everything ought to be moving. So we hear about food, right? Well, in a lot of cases, food is free. I mean, I know it's not always the case, but where I live, there are occasionally these tech meetups. You can go to a meetup about Python or JavaScript or whatever, and these companies will host these events and they'll just provide pizza. So, I mean, I could probably go for months never paying for a meal if I just would, you know, go downtown to a meetup, you know, every day and eat pizza. Like you could do it. You can find situations where food is basically free, you know, because the incremental cost is low enough that it's worth providing. So I feel like in a Bitcoinized future that I very much look forward to, more things go the direction of air, water, and food. Like things are just available and they're so cheap that we don't think of them as costing anything. Like they're just available and you can pay for better versions. You can pay for better food. You can pay for better clothes, you know, but it's just available because there's so much abundance. The only reason we don't live in that world now is because, you know, the ravages of inflation just gobble up the extra value that otherwise would be produced by technological improvements. But anyway, I don't fear people having things to do. I don't fear, the technological singularity. I think that in order for people to own things, they do need to know and understand keys and key management. I think that's like going to become a crucial thing. If you don't know that, you're going to be subject to somebody else who does. But overall, I don't fear the loss of work.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I like your vision. I like the idea of Jimbo going down to the old Python meetup and everybody looking at him like, ah, he's here just for the pizza again.
Dude, there was a dude who I went to a couple of different meetups. I only went to the Python one like once. I went to, you know, some database ones a few times. I went to the JavaScript one a few times. And there was a dude that I always saw. I think he just lived off the free pizza at the tech meetups. I don't think he was even a programmer. Just, you know. He just showed up at all the meetups.
What a legend. Yeah. Stacking sats any way possible, hopefully.
Yeah.
All right, Ben, I need to ask this question. I know where you claim you're a multi-sig maximalist. So give me I don't even have a question. Just like kind of tell me about multisig, why it's important, why you think people should do it, or what your thoughts are on multisig and why you consider yourself a multisig maximalist.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. So, okay. So, again, coming around to the question a little sideways, in Bitcoin, knowledge is ownership. Doing a multi-sig wallet is more complex than doing a single sig wallet. So what that means is if you're going to do it, you need to be more knowledgeable. I don't know that everybody is ready for that today. I hope the tooling will get better. I don't know how much better it can get. But the reason that I'm a multi-sig maximalist has to do with what we talked about earlier about what a hardware wallet does. Your hardware wallet protects your private keys from leaks during use. So you have a hardware wallet, say. Let's say you just go and you get any random one. Hardware vendor A. You go and get hardware wallet vendor A. Okay, so now the first question is, where does your seed come from? Right now, if you just use the device and make a seed, like just have it, make new wallet, and then here are your words, you write them down. Now we have to ask the philosophical question that we've touched on a few times in this podcast, which is, how do you know? Right? So it gave me these words. How do I know that those words go to the addresses that it's telling me this is where I can receive Bitcoin? How do I know? Well, if you just trust it, then you don't know, right? Maybe it's lying to you. Maybe it just gave you some random words, but the address is really to somebody else, right? How do you know, right? So that's one problem. Then, supposing that those words do actually go to that address, the follow-up question is, how do I know that nobody else got these words, right? Are these the same words that everybody gets when they start up this wallet? Hopefully not. Hopefully it's random. But how do you know it's random? How do you know that there isn't a database of all of the keys that hardware vendor A has ever made back at hardware vendor A's headquarters, and they're just waiting to rug pull everybody on one fateful day where they just empty everybody's wallets? You don't know, right? You can't know, right? So first and foremost, I have to say, if you're using a hardware wallet or any wallet really, and it's showing you like, here are these words, this is your wallet, how do you know? You don't know that that's actually random. You don't know that nobody has those things. So at creation time, when you're creating the keys, my recommendation is to do that offline. And there are ways to do that. I've made one. I made one that uses playing cards because that's what I happen to like. You can do it by rolling dice. Although, again, if you're putting dice rolls into your hardware wallet and then your hardware wallet is telling you, oh yeah, those dice rolls made these words, now you're back to the same question of like, how do you know? So I actually don't like dice rolls as far as like you put the dice roll in the hardware wallet and then it tells you the words, because it just brings back up the same question of how do you know. If you're going to use dice, you need to be able to do it on like an offline lookup table where you roll the dice and then you've got a table that tells you, okay, you rolled a one, a six, and two fives and a four. That's the word about or whatever, right? I don't know if that's even in the word. Bacon is in the word list. I can say that one, right? That's the word bacon. So you generate your keys offline. Okay, so now I've generated my keys offline. I have my offline seeds generated. So I know that I made the seeds because I rolled the dice, or I looked it up in a table, or I picked words out of a hat, or I shuffled the cards. Okay, so I know that this seed has never been anywhere but me because my randomness is good and I made it myself. Okay, now I put that in the wallet. I put it in the hardware wallet. The hardware wallet says, thanks for entering your seed. Here's your address. How do you know? How do you know that that address goes to those seed words, right? Well, you're trusting that hardware wallet. And this is where multisig comes in, right? If you have another hardware vendor B, and you put the same words in hardware vendor A, and you put the same words in hardware vendor B, and they both give you the same addresses, now you can be fairly confident that neither of them are lying to you because they would both have to be in on the same farce, especially if you made those words yourself. Right? And this is why I recommend multi-vendor multi-sig. Don't just have multi-sig where it's the same vendor. Have them from different vendors. That way, if any particular vendor got fucked, your stuff is still okay. Right? So that's part of the reason I recommend the multi-sig. And then also, like I said, the purpose of the hardware wallet is to protect your keys from leaks during use. If there was a wallet that leaked your keys during use, right? If you're using a multi-sig, you would only lose one of your keys and not the other ones. Now, you might not know it when it happens, but if there was a hardware vendor that was leaking seed material, you would probably hear about it in the Bitcoin news. And then you'd be like, oh shit, I had that hardware wallet. I better abandon that key and make a new wallet and move my shit over, right? So you might not know at the moment that it happens, but by using multisig, it's not catastrophic. It just means that you need to make a new wallet without that vendor, whatever vendor that is.
Fucking legendary, man. I love how paranoid Bitcoiners are. It's good. And you're right. Just analyzing what you're doing, how you're doing it, and what it means and how it's working is a good thing to do, especially for somebody skeptical coming into Bitcoin saying, oh, I don't trust this thing. It's like, you don't have to trust it. You can fucking double check and triple check every single aspect of this network, how it works, verify every transaction, and double check every transaction you send. Like the amount of security that you want in your Bitcoin life is really, I won't say limitless, but virtually limitless, depending on you as an individual and how far you want to go with it. And that's what I think makes Bitcoin, that's one of the reasons why I think Bitcoin is important. I want to ask you about, I want to get you to shill your book because I feel bad. I don't even know about this one. So I want to hear about it. But before we get into that, is there anything that you wanted to touch on in this show that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, I mean, I guess real quick, I would say I listened to the Big Sean Harris episode.
Oh, right on.
Great stuff. One thing that he mentioned about his early journey is that he had, you know, one friend who was, you know, using Bitcoin to you know, buy drugs on Silk Road. And, well, you can just ignore one friend. And then he had a second friend who was like, you know, a straight edge, you know, dude who was into it for some other reason. And that was when Sean was like, okay, maybe there is something to this. And I thought that was a really great vignette of a pattern that is, I think, crucial in life psychology, which is if you know one person who's into something, you can ignore them and just be like, well, that's just that one weirdo, right? When you hear from a second independent person, right, somebody who you think is separate, which like it was in Sean's story, then that's something interesting. Like the second independent signal is signal. The first signal might be noise and you're like, I don't know. Second signal, it's like, that's something I should look into. So today, I know Bitcoin has some amount of adoption, but most people know zero Bitcoiners. Most people don't know anybody, right? Or if they do know somebody, they don't know they're into Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoiners don't necessarily talk about it all the time. I mean, we do, but you know, maybe some don't for some reason. So most people know zero Bitcoiners. People who know any Bitcoiners mostly know just one. And it's just that one weirdo that they're ignoring. So, and people who know two or more Bitcoiners are Bitcoiners, right? That's kind of the way it works. If once you know two, it's like, oh, okay, now you're really in. So I think this is part of the explanation for why gradually then suddenly will eventually play out. Today, almost nobody knows any. But once you know one, you can ignore them. But once you know two, then it's like, oh, maybe I should look into that. If you know three people that are all into something and you're not into it, now it's like, oh, holy shit, I now have FOMO. I have literal fear of missing out on whatever this thing is. So I think that's I just wanted to point out in Sean's story, I thought it was a really useful example of a general pattern, and which is why you shouldn't necessarily get discouraged if you talk to somebody about Bitcoin and they don't seem to get it. You might just be that first weirdo, right? And it won't be until the second weirdo or the third weirdo that they hear about it that they actually take that as signal.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. Adoption's only going to go up, that's for sure. But while you were saying that, I was just fucking brain went to shitcoins again. And that really is what it is, man, because you hear these fucking shitcoins going up and those things skyrocket to just absurd numbers. And then that's what happens. You know, one guy says it, another guy says it, it's all over the news. So now everybody gets that FOMO for fucking shitcoin A, B, or C. And then they all go in, they ape in, and they fucking lose all their money. So, and people often confuse Bitcoin being part of that whatever group, which it's not, but so long as Bitcoiners keep trying to share and explain, yeah, I'm a Bitcoiner, Bitcoin's different than shitcoins, we're still going to have those shitcoin cycles where it's like, oh, well, so-and-so bought this coin and so-and-so bought this coin, so I guess I should buy this coin. Eventually, that's going to shift over to, oh, so-and-so realized that fiat's dead and Bitcoin's the only way. But yeah, it'll just take a little while to get there. But I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Back in 2017, when I was falling down the rabbit hole and I felt like I was late and I was trying to catch up, I too dabbled in the trading of shitcoins. I never wanted to hold any. I never was like, oh yeah, this is going to be the new thing, you know, whatever, Link Marines and all that other bullshit. I was never one of those, but I was like, maybe I can trade these shitcoins. Maybe I can do trading. Maybe I can do that to catch up. But I wasn't really confident because I was like, I don't, you know, it seems like a casino, but I should at least learn how this works. So I started looking at charts and I started trying to figure out, like, how do people trade these things? And of all things, I was looking at the Doge chart in dollars and I was watching it and it was doing this really weird pattern. And when I say weird pattern, I don't mean in charting terms, like, you know, people draw arrows and stuff. What I meant was like the candles would move little bits, but then they would jump and then the candle would jump again and it would jump. And I didn't understand why, like what was going on here. And what I eventually realized was like, okay, I needed to look at the Doge chart priced in sats, because in sats, all those little wiggles that I was seeing, that was the Bitcoin price in dollars changing. The Doge coins were actually being traded in sats. And so the big jumps that I was seeing was when it was moving in whole sat increments. Now today, a Doge is, I don't know, 300 sats or something. So you're not going to see that one sat increment. But at the time that I was looking at it, it was like, you know, 20 sats. And so moving one sat, which was the smallest unit of movement that the Doge could move, it would move one sat, but it would be 5% of the price. So it'd be this huge jump when you looked at it in dollar terms. So that was when I realized, I was like, oh, okay, I need to be looking at these charts in sats. So then I went back to all the shitcoins that I had previously been looking at, and I started looking at that in the BTC price of those same things, and it started telling the same story. And if you ever look at a shitcoin chart in sats terms, they all tell the same story. So it starts off high, maybe it goes down, and then it spikes, and then it comes down, and then it spikes up, and then it comes down, and spikes up, and each time it spikes less, and it just trends towards zero, right? And I was like, oh, okay, so that's how these things work. So anyway, the reason I bring that up is because I was buying a dog 6 months ago, and this particular dog guy said that he accepted crypto. He says, okay, so what do you think about this stuff? And I said, well, Bitcoin's a real deal and the rest of it is shit, right? And kind of took the wind out of his sails. And he says, oh yeah, but I was looking at ADA or, you know, some of these other ones. I thought maybe they had to go somewhere. I said, okay, so first of all, you have to understand that Bitcoin is the market and the rest of this stuff you're comparing to that. So if you're going to trade, use the BTC price. And I got out my phone and I opened up TradingView and I was like, okay, what was the coin you're talking about? And I like looked it up. I think it was ADA. It might've been something else. I said, okay, let's look at it in dollars. In dollars, you see all this motion and it looks like it might be going up or blah, blah. Okay, now ignore that. Let's look at the BTC price. And you look at the BTC price and it's a typical shitcoin chart where it spiked and now it's like trending downwards and maybe spiking. It's not. So I said to him, I'm like, if you're going to buy this garbage, excuse me, you're betting that you can time when it's going to do one of these spikes. Do you think that it's going to spike again? It might not. Some of these other ones don't. I would bring up like Litecoin or some of these old coins that people don't remember anymore. And I would just show how they just tail off. And I said, so this was a huge coin 4 years ago and nobody talks about it now, but this was a coin that people were trying to trade exactly like what you're talking about now. So if you're going to trade shit coins, at least use BTC as your denominator because everything is pegged on that. Like that is the market, right? And once I showed that to him, I could tell he kind of like lost the taste for shitcoinery because like he's like, oh, well, these charts aren't nearly as fun to look at as when I was looking at them in dollar terms because the dollar one encodes all of the Bitcoin price plus the additional volatility of the shitcoin. So that's what I would say is like, you don't necessarily have to tell people that shitcoins are bad. What you can do is you can say, if you're going to trade them, look at them in Bitcoin terms. Let's look at a few examples and I'll show you, this is what you're trying to time. You're trying to time this market. You can see that it's trending down and spiking up, but each spike is lower than the previous spike. Are you able to guess when the spike is going to occur? And is there going to be enough volume on whatever shitcoin casino to allow you to cash out, you know, if you bet correctly? Those are questions you have to answer. But if you're going to trade, that's the way you got to do it. So that would be my advice for trying to help people get out of their shitcoinery is help them do shitcoinery better by showing them that the BTC is the denominator, and then they'll come to their own conclusion that it was stupid to try.
Oh yeah, man. Isn't it interesting? CoinMarketCap used to be my go-to to look at that, and they just disabled the ability to look at these fucking shitcoins in Bitcoin terms. It's just not there anymore. Those bastards. So, whatever. There's clearly a reason they did that, and I just... Whatever. Shitcoiner's gonna shitcoin, but you're absolutely right. Once people realize this is the denominator, Bitcoin is the denominator, this is what you want to get. That's all that really matters. All right, man. Show me your book, dude. What did you write? A Bitcoin book. Fuck. Tell me all about it.
Oh yeah. So like I said, my objective was to initially to just explain what I thought my colleagues needed to hear. So I wrote this book called Orange Coin Good, which at the time was a big meme. You know, it was like the caveman says Orange Coin Good. And it was meant to be a 4-part series, but I haven't written any of the other parts yet. And really, I was just trying to answer the question, you know, how can this crazy internet money that's not backed by anything have any value at all? So it goes into kind of why we need it, how it works, you know, what does it achieve? And I kind of make some predictions about the direction I think things are going to go. But I talk about, you know, fungibility and hardness. And let's see, I'm just scrolling through here.
Is it available as a physical book or just a online thing or?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon.
Okay, right.
If you search for Orange Coin Good by Jimbo, it'll be on there. So the reason you probably haven't heard of it is because I do no marketing. I'm not good at the whole marketing like angle. And in writing this book, I made a mistake. I wrote this book for a like pre-coiner audience. So I felt like there's a lot of good resources already. If you're already of a kind of libertarian anarcho-capitalist bent, there's plenty of good material out there. If you're not already in that camp, I feel like the materials are maybe a little harder to come by. So I was trying to write something that would appeal to a more center-left audience than the anarcho-capitalist audience. So I used, rather than talking about liberty and ownership as kind of like my core moral values, I chose to use reciprocity as my core moral value to argue for Bitcoin. My mistake was that, of course, I'm writing for a pre-coiner audience, but pre-coiner audiences aren't looking for books on Bitcoin. So the market isn't there. If I was really, you know, I think in order to be successful, I really need to write a book that Bitcoiners want to read. And so it's not this one. I mean,
that's fair,
I learned a lot writing it. I think it stands up, but yeah, I've been thinking that the book and I go back and forth about whether I should try to write a book or just make software, but I've been thinking that there needs to be a book, something like, you know, the Bitcoin Security Bible that just goes through like end to end, like, okay, here's the chapters on how to run a node. Here are the chapters on how to generate seeds offline. Here are the chapters on how to use all these different hardware wallets. Here are the chapters on how to set up multisig. Here are the chapters on, you know, doing inheritance planning with, you know, pre-signed long dated Bitcoin transactions, just recipes for all that stuff. I feel like that book might be something that Bitcoiners would buy.
That's definitely needed, dude. Yeah, if you have the ability to do that, I would definitely check that out. And I definitely feel you, like, so we've been doing this podcast for, I don't know, a while now, and we've separated it out into seasons, because the season I came in, I'm like, I got to talk to all the people that don't know what Bitcoin is. I got to explain all these things to people that don't know Bitcoin. And then you realize quickly, oh, people that don't understand Bitcoin don't care about Bitcoin. So then you start talking to regular Bitcoiners and you're like, okay, well, these guys know all this shit. And you talk to hardcore Bitcoiners and you're like, yeah, these guys are crazy, they know way more shit than me. So it's like, it's this delicate balance. There's so many different types of Bitcoiners, pre-coiners and no coiners, and to try and target who you want to talk to is one of the most difficult challenges of being a creator, as it were, in this space. So I definitely feel that, but I'll check out your book. I'm curious to see it, man. That's really cool. I guess we'll, this has been a great chat, dude. I'd love to talk to you forever. You're an awesome fucking Bitcoiner, but we cannot do that. But I'll definitely get you back on again and we can ramble about some more Bitcoin stuff. But as for now, if you could just leave our listeners, let them know where to find you on Twitter or anything else you want to lead them towards. At least give the link again for your book and any other projects you're working on.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, so my handle on Twitter is at JimboCoin, no underscores or dashes or anything. But I've been posting less and less on Twitter lately. When Elon put the Doge logo on there, it was really a slap in the face, kind of the last straw, as it were. So I've been more on Nostr these days. My Nostr NPub is unpronounceable, like they all are, but it is in my Twitter bio. So if you go to Twitter, at JimboCoin on my bio, my NPub is the first thing there, and you can paste it and find me over on Nostr.
Right on, man. Good shit. Yeah. Elon recently just got rid of the fucking bar at the bottom of Twitter when you're scrolling. And I feel like that's my final straw. I might be migrating over to Nostr finally. I'm kind of famous for saying, fuck Nostr, I don't need this yet. And I think I might need it now, man. So you might catch me over there.
Well, sooner, yeah, I've sooner than Nostr. Well, there's been a couple of things that have tried, I think. One was Mastodon. I don't know if you remember, pre-Elon Twitter, there was a lot of like censorship going on. And so for a little bit there, people were over on Mastodon. Mastodon, unfortunately, your ID is tied to a Mastodon server. You can run your own server, but almost nobody did. So, you know, your ID was kind of tied there. And it was not as good as Twitter. Like the feed was not quite as good, and obviously all the people weren't there, right? So any new network has to be amazing in some way other than content, because the content won't be there relative to Twitter. So Mastodon kind of failed. Another thing that was tried that I was hopeful for, but I haven't really heard anybody talk about in a while, so I think it might, I mean, I don't know how it's going these days, but I haven't heard anything, so that, take that for what it's worth, is Sphinx. Used its messaging protocol piggybacked on Lightning key sends. So in Lightning, you can do what's called a key send, which is if you know somebody's node, you can just send them coins over Lightning without getting a an invoice first, or maybe there's an invoice that happens behind the scenes. I'm not 100% sure how all that works, but Sphinx used the fact that Lightning key send events, where you send somebody small amounts of sats, can piggyback a payload message along with it, and it used that as its messaging protocol, and then had end-to-end encryption. So you would still have your private key on your local client, and you would chat with others, and it would be end-to-end encrypted both ways, but the payloads would be sent over Lightning. So as a result of that design choice, in Sphinx, it was very easy to send people Lightning, because everything was Lightning all the time. It was constantly sending like little 3-sat messages back and forth in order to carry the payloads of all these messages. And so it was easy to just piggyback additional sats if you wanted to send sats. So I thought that looked really promising. For some reason, that didn't really take off. The reason that I think Nostr is going to win where these other things have failed is not because it does better on content, right? It has the same problem that Mastodon and Sphinx had with regards to content. The content is not there yet, and it'll be a while before it is, and it may never be, because everybody's on Twitter, and how do you compete with everybody? You know, it's very difficult. But what Nostr has going for it, in addition to easy integration with Lightning wallets, it's not quite as easy as Sphinx, because it's not piggybacking over top of Lightning, at least not yet, but it does have good integration with Lightning. It's relatively easy to send somebody some sats. In Nostr terms, it's called zapping. And that's very common. It's common for people to have the plebs will do these like zapathons where they're just all like zapping each other and stuff. And so that's kind of the content. So it has good integration with Lightning, although not as integrated as Sphinx. But the other thing that's really great about Nostr, as opposed to some of these other platforms, is that your ID is really just a private public key pair that you generate. So you generate, just like you would generate your Bitcoin seed, and you can do that offline using, you know, dice rolling or picking cards out of a hat, you can generate your Nostr private public key pair. And then that private key you can paste in any other Nostr client, and you'll have, it's like you're logging in there. So what this allows is it allows the competition of different Nostr clients. You can have different Nostr client implementations competing for people to use them. And then meanwhile, all the content is preserved and the content is relayed through these, you know, relay software. And there are multiple implementations of relays, and relays have different properties. Some relays are pay to relay. So for example, a pay to relay that you use, you pay once, and then now you have access to be able to post your stuff through that relay. The benefit of using a pay to relay is that all of the content coming out of that is pretty much guaranteed not to be a spam bot, because spam bots would just, it would be too expensive to build a bunch of spam bots and you know, pay for all of them to relay. So you can look at the feed from a pay to relay, and it's you know, it's at least people who cared enough to pay, right, exclusively, versus other relays are free, and then relays can have their own rules about which types of messages or what frequency of messages or what volume of messages or who, right? Relays can make their own choices. So you have competition and active development at the relay level. The relays are all relaying content. The client is receiving content, and then the user ID is entirely separate, and you can take it with you to any other client and get all the same material from any number of relays. So I know I've gone way on a huge tangent. You were trying to wrap up, and I apologize for that. But the point that I'm making here is that I think Nostr is more likely to succeed because it adds the addition of competition at multiple layers of the protocol implementation that these other competing systems that were also centralized or less decentralized, I'll say, didn't have those features.
That's probably the best shill for Nostr I've heard, and I've heard a lot of shills for Nostr, man. I really think I'm going to be over there sooner or later. Absolutely. Dude, I'd fucking love to talk with you for hours, but my program that I'm running here only goes for another 8 minutes, goddamn. So I gotta update this software, dude. I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Yeah, I'll definitely get you back on. We can rant about Nostr because I do have thoughts, but I think my aggression towards it is waning for sure. I'll be over there sooner or later. Thanks for all your info on fucking nodes and multisig. You're an extremely intelligent dude. You definitely know your shit. So anybody listening here, definitely go check him out. That's JimboCoin on Twitter or on Nostr. Thanks again. We'll see ya. And as always, oh fuck. I have ads I have to read. Hey, if you're listening to this, this podcast is sponsored by River. Go check out River. I don't have the links. I'm a terrible podcast producer. River's great. Check them out. I will have the links in the show notes. And oh fuck, Fountain Boosts. I forgot all that too. We're on Fountain. I'll read the boosts next week. Sorry, folks. This was a good chat, man. I felt good talking to Bitcoiners, man. It time just fucking flies by when you're talking about Bitcoin, doesn't it? Absolutely. And what else? Oh, there's a Bitcoin rodeo coming up in Calgary. Jimbo, I don't know where you're at, but it's going to be one of the best Bitcoin conferences, gatherings of Bitcoiners. It's happening in Calgary. If you want to come, use code YPOD, that's WHYPOD, and you can get $60 off your ticket, and it's going to be awesome. All the best Bitcoiners are in Calgary. That's a fact. All right, that's all my shills. Check us out. If you enjoyed the show, consider sharing it with a friend. If you want to support us, send us some sats on Fountain. That'd be cool. All right, peace and love. As always, if ever you're staring at the sky, you're wondering, what is this Bitcoin thing? Why not just wonder, why is this Bitcoin thing? All right. Cut.